Welcome to Holden Village. Robert Benny is giving a session this afternoon entitled The Church and Politics, Hot and Direct.
Tomorrow in my final session, I'll try to elaborate in much more detail what I think the Lutheran stance toward the political process ought to be and how it contributes some very important insights to all other religious groups, I think. That's the gist of my books, The Paradoxical Vision, A Public Theology for the 21st Century, where I argue that Lutheranism gives a kind of a framework for the church to deal with politics that I think is indispensable if the church is to maintain its integrity and the political spheres to maintain its integrity. So I don't want to spend a lot more time on the paradox right now. Christ above culture. The classic Catholic way of ecclesial dominance and direction of society, which is very ready and willing to engage in the political process. Christ transforming culture, the classic Calvinist or Reformed, which again has a very vigorous attitude toward politics and a robust idea of the church's involvement in politics. And Christ of culture being liberal and individualistic Christians who revise the Christian faith according to the enlightened culture of the day and also are very politically active. That's a very, very quick summary. Perhaps what was interesting is to identify current trends and religious groupings with this chart. There is a kind of a neo-sectarianism that has emerged in America associated with the name of Stanley Hauerwas and John Howard Yoder, who argue for a Christ against culture position and Christians being a counterculture, but they're not politically escapist or politically reserved. They think neo-sectarians have an impact, should have an impact on the political sphere, not directly, but to expose what the world really is. And then we talked about how the old mainstream Protestant groups, which were very powerful in shaping America, the Presbyterians, the Methodists, the Episcopals, who are now kind of less potent in their political effect, have been overtaken and the baton passed, as it were, to conservative evangelicals, particularly the Southern Baptists, who are very transformative in their vision about the role of religion and their church in political life. And that being an interesting new emergence. But I don't want to go over that again. That's kind of a quick capsule of what we've been doing the last 2 days. That was dealing with what kinds of Christian traditions we have in America and how their theological decisions affect and color their political involvement. Today, I want to get to the hot and cool of things, not so much what kind of Christian tradition we're talking about, but how these various Christian traditions affect the public political sphere. And we could talk about the public in a general way of economics, politics, society. But by and large, we're focused on politics in this series, so I'll try to emphasize that. And I've distinguished the ways that religious traditions, organized religions, affects politics by two big major divisions. Indirect, which I call cool and less controversial ways of affecting the political sphere or engaging in the political sphere, and the direct or hot ways of doing it, which are much more controversial, much more high risk, and tend to create a lot more controversy. So let's take a look at these categories, because I think as I develop them, you'll find them interesting and provocative. By indirect, I simply mean that the church as an institution doesn't become an actor as an institution in politics. It doesn't do it directly as an institution. It is not an institutional actor in the political sphere. Rather, it affects politics in the public sphere indirectly, basically through its laity, essentially through its laity. And for organized groups of laity who are not under the direct control of the church. The first one is what I call unintentional and indirect. And I designate that the ethics of character. And by that I mean this. When the church is really the church in a vigorous sense, its proclamation, its teaching, its corporate life, it affects deeply the character of people and their outlook on the world. And I would argue that maybe this is the most powerful and deep-running way that the church affects the world in general, by shaping deeply the character and vision of its laity, the people who participate in it. And the really strong religious traditions have performed what you could call a revolution of the heart or a revolution of vision, so that people view the world in a different way and act out their faith in a very distinct and disciplined way. Now, that then shapes people deeply, and then they move into the sectors of society that the church as an institution can't reach directly, nor can the clergy reach directly. But it's the laity who are basically in the public political slots of society. It's the laity who are in business. It's the laity who are in the professions. It's the laity who are in the administration of homes, institutions. So this is very close to Luther's notion of the calling of Christians, and that the church is first of all a nurture of the laity and their sense of callings. So the calling of the church is to nurture the calling of the laity. But in order for the laity to have a calling, they have to be deeply affected by the liturgical life of the church, the sacramental life, the teaching, the corporate life, which shapes people. One of the classic studies of this way of affecting the world was done by Max Weber, who was one of the pioneers of sociology, who wrote a famous book, which probably most of you have heard of, called The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. And in that book, Weber argued that Calvinism, particularly a certain kind of Calvinism, shaped the outlook and character of its adherents, its laity, so deeply that they provided the energies and the direction and the legitimation for the development of capitalism. And he called the kind of piety that Calvinism shaped deeply in their people, he called that inner-worldly asceticism. Inner-worldly asceticism. The whole medieval arrangement had been extra-world asceticism, extra-worldly asceticism. If you wanted to adopt the heroic Christian virtues of faith, love, and hope, you became a priest or a nun went to a monastery or nunnery. And this was an ascetic lifestyle, but it was otherworldly. Now, Weber said the Protestants brought off a major revolution in the way people looked at work, because the Protestants, Calvinists particularly, believed that it was in your earthly calling that you glorified God. And the glorification of God in your earthly calling had something to do with being a success in your calling. And so a great deal of energy was unleashed into the world in these Protestants who believed that by being a good business person, they were glorifying God. By being a good teacher, they were glorifying God. So it gave a kind of a sacred legitimation to work, or at least gave work a serious dimension to it, a religious dimension. So the Protestant ethic we still use to designate that deeper sense of piety, that what I'm doing in my work is religiously meaningful and morally meaningful. So, but at the same time, Weber said, Calvinism was an austere faith. It was not sensual. And one shouldn't spend one's well-earned money on enjoying oneself or building sumptuous churches or holidays or religious ritual. So the Puritans were a part of that Calvinist strain, had very austere churches. Their rituals were plain and spare if they had them. They did away with the festivals and the holidays, and they were ascetic, but they were hardworking ascetics, and they glorified God in their occupation, and they kept an austere lifestyle. Well, what is that formula? What's that a formula for? Weber says it's a formula for capital formation. People working hard, making money, saving and not spending on themselves, but saving it, and engaging in this kind of energetic work in the emerging market economy. Weber's argument was the Calvinists gave that a real push. So he noticed that the Calvinist parts of Europe were the capitalist parts of Europe were Calvinist. Lutherans lagged a little bit further behind economically, and the Catholics lagged all the way behind. Yeah?
I just thought of something, the Calvinistic word ethic. It seems to me that the Jewish nation had a similar ethic whereby you were given gifts, mm-hmm. and it was your obligation to use those gifts as best as possible. Was there a tie-in or like a dovetail? I'm just curious, because it's the first time I thought about the two together.
Well, that's a good question, and I doubt if there's a whole lot of interaction between the two, because the Jews were kept in ghettos and were sequestered off into certain kinds of occupations, like banking, where because others couldn't do it, they had kind of a monopoly on it, and they made a lot of money out of it, and that kind of became a rationale for prejudice against the Jews. But I think probably they had their own sources of for this energetic ethic. And I would doubt if there's a whole lot of connection between the two. The distinctions that are made by Weber between the medieval ethos, which wasn't this driving energy and work, and nor was it ascetic in a worldly sense, particularly for the laity. So, at any rate, I'm using this merely as an illustration. The Calvinists were not out to construct capitalism. They were not out to effect a major revolution in economic life. But because they created this powerful piety, they in fact had a great effect on economic life. Another example, Alfred Lord Lindsay wrote a book called The Essentials of Democracy. And he talks about how the dissenting Protestant groups in England developed an equalitarian and democratic mode of decision making within their churches. And that this played a very important role in the emergence of English democracy. And of course, they didn't set out to effect a political revolution or a political reformation, but that was the effect. Now you find this way of affecting the world deep in the modern world. I live in the South now, and when I teach business ethics, I'm amazed at how these Baptist people have been so deeply shaped by their faith that they want to lead their business in a Christian way, and they're searching for that. There's a direct connection, perhaps, between that Puritan sense of the work ethic and the modern-day Baptists, and they hunger for connections between their religion and their economic life. And you feel that they've been deeply shaped and formed along these patterns. Now, rather than tarrying too long on this, I just want to make a couple further remarks. One is among the family of Lutherans, probably the Missouri Synod has been the one who kind of goes this far and doesn't go much further than that. But the Missouri Synod has had a powerful effect upon people had a strong religious tradition, and does implant in them a deep sense of calling, oftentimes a sense of justice, a sense of the way the world should be, and they spin off a lot of interesting characters running from somebody like Ed Meese on the one hand to Paul Simon on the other hand, or the Bread for the World people, Art Simon and that group. So a lot of lay people, as I go around the churches, would like to stop right here with how the church should have a political effect. The church does its essential things: the gospel, worship, teaching, these sorts of things, deeply forms the character of people, sets the laity free to work into the world in the various places. After all, the institutional church can't reach those places, doesn't have a whole lot of wisdom about those places, and it respects the role of the laity to go ahead and make their decisions after they've been formed deeply. And by and large, a lot of lay folks don't want to go any further than that. They don't want to heighten the political conversation in the churches. What they want to do is form people and set them free to do what they discern that they should do in the world. Any questions? This is. I'll ratchet it up a little bit more to a little bit. This is pretty cool, but pretty non-controversial. Not many people disagree with this kind of way of the church affecting politics, but I would contend that it's perhaps the most important one. And there's kind of an irony is when the church tends to lose its character-forming capacity of shaping people deeply, it often becomes much more aggressive institutionally and tries to shape the society. That it doesn't. So one of my Catholic friends who has never participated real strongly in the pro-life movement has reservations about that. He says because Catholics participate in abortion just as much as anybody else does. If the church were really the church and affecting the character of people, it would first attend to its own internal life and the life of Catholics and not try to agitate or legislate to the rest of the folks. First, it would try to do the kind of character forming that would make a big difference in the way Catholics behaved and not try to wield its power or influence. Well, most folks who really think about it think that that doesn't go far enough, that the church has a broader responsibility to hold up the law to the rest of the society, that is God's will for the rest of the society. But those same thoughtful folks would say that a lot of times laity don't make the connections between Sunday and Monday. That is, even if they're good people formed in their character, that when they get into the world eats them up, or the world sets the agenda. And so they tend to bifurcate their lives between Sunday and Monday and kind of live these kind of separated lives. I can attest to a lot of that in the business world, but I teach at a college, and you get wonderful Christian people who are very deeply involved in their church life, and you get them into college, and they don't think their religious convictions have anything to do with the life of the college, which is a church-related college. So some of the most difficult people I encounter or engage at Roanoke College are people who are great Baptists on Sunday but don't see any connection between that and their calling on the world. So in the political sphere, that's also perhaps even more true, that there's a wide gap between what happens in the church and what happens from Monday to Saturday in the political sphere. So I add another level called the ethics of conscience, which is refers to much more intentionality, much more self-conscious reflection. And I call that intentional. Still indirect. The church as an institution is not the main actor in the political sphere. It's indirect, but the church gets much more intentional about connecting the moral heritage of its tradition with public political events and challenges. So I have three different little ways of talking about that. Applying its moral heritage to the issues of the day, public, political, or economic issues, and applying it in several ways. Let me elaborate a little bit what I think that might mean. That might mean at the local level what the ELCA calls fostering moral deliberation. That is, taking the teachings of the church, self-consciously connecting them with issues that are facing people in the world, and creating, at least making the connection between the moral heritage and the challenges of the day, so that people begin to connect their Sunday and their Monday life. That's a lot easier to said than done, to carry out moral deliberation at the parish level, because a lot of lay folks, one, don't want to go any further than that. They come to church for peaceableness. They don't come to be disturbed. So it's easier said than done, but it certainly can be done. And the ELCA with its statements and other church traditions with their statements that's a good place to start. What does the church teach, and how do you bring lay people in such an environment where their conscience is awakened, or their conscience is shaped, or at least they're challenged to think about it? And that's the next level, it seems to me, of applying the moral heritage of the church and the moral teachings of the church, social teachings of the church, with laity at the local level. But this can be done at the synodical level, and certainly is done at the national level. My hunch is that we don't spend enough time on that sort of engagement at the parish level. And one of the criticisms I have of church and society is that they spend too much time on making the statements and not fostering ways to have that deliberation going on, although I know that you want that to go on. There's an organization within, loosely related to the ELCA, called the Lutheran Academy. Anybody ever been to their events? Bill Deal and others who have been very active in lay ministry in the ELCA have a little organization called the Lutheran Academy that tries to get together lay people and theologians and ethicists to think about specific problems. So they'll try to gather business persons or teachers. Or one that I went to in Iowa was with farmers who were being really pressed hard by the economy. And pull these two people together so that a lively interaction can go on. Not try to come up with any statement or any decision or any Christian way to go, but at least awaken theological and moral reflection on these issues. Peter Berger calls the church a mediating institution. And one way it mediates, it seems to me, is by mediating the moral heritage of the church with the laity, so that the conscience of the laity are raised and they're energized to think about these things. Another way, it seems to me, is the Lutheran Academy tries to do this, but the European academies, the evangelical academies in Germany, were classic examples of mediating institutions where they would bring together sometimes people of opposing viewpoints. One of the classic examples of this is one of the evangelical academies near Stuttgart has a great history of bringing labor and management from Mercedes-Benz together in their evangelical academy, where they talk about the issues that they grapple with in a kind of a graceful environment with theologians and ethicists of the church part of the conversation. And they don't try to resolve it, but they try to provide that environment and that conversation. And one of the interesting things about it was that for about 40 years, Mercedes-Benz never had a strike because of this mediating function played by the church. and in which the church would also inject its moral reflection into things. And that can be done on a lot of different levels, on a lot of different issues, when you bring people of opposing viewpoints together. And the farm one that I went to, the Lutheran Academy, had large farmers who believed that government policy was going in the right direction, and smaller farmers who believed that it was a disaster. And you got people, Christian people, trying to work that out together. My hunch is that we could do a lot more of that in the church, and we don't. And I would think that's one of the places where we could really beef up our efforts at the synodical, local, and the national level. A second one, you get what I mean about this application. Our local congregation, a wonderful example. Many local congregations have worked with the sexuality statement, and that's an example of what I mean. But right after the Gulf War, remember the dramatic Wednesday night, wasn't it, when the shooting began? Boy, that was a tense time. And the next Sunday, we had a forum in the basement of our church, and several people were asked to kind of elaborate their thoughts about what had happened. And they were on different wavelengths. And we had the most marvelous conversation on that, in which people didn't go away mad or angry, but they had different positions. But all of them then took seriously what some of the Christian moral principles were in the whole matter. Well, those are examples of applying or trying to heighten the ethics of conscience. And it's less controversial, it's a little warmer than the first kind, but the church isn't taking a stand particularly, and the church itself is not an actor in the public process. Now there's a second kind, I call embodying the ethos, or embodying the moral heritage of the church, or embodying the vision of the church. And this is the institutions of the church. Here's another place where I think we have a real challenge, and I think I know something about it because I teach in one of the institutions of the church. Richard Niebuhr, in a famous essay entitled The Responsibility of the Church, said the church's most persuasive way of addressing society is to embody its own message in its institutions. Its own practices should reflect what its fundamental commitments are in its institutional life, not only in the church itself, but in the institutions that are related to it. And that, he thought, was a much more persuasive than social statements, much more persuasive than direct action by the church, because it showed how the church could embody its vision. So, think of all the real institutions of the church who have basically lost their zeal or their confidence in taking seriously their own Christian heritage and Christian mission. And we could start with the ELCA colleges, and I'll speak of my own, which almost lost its connection to the church and to the Christian heritage. And one of the things I was hired to do when I left seminary teaching and go to college was try to make those connections. And it's a long, hard path, because you filled the college, not filled it, but you had a large time of recruitment of faculty who didn't care about the church-related nature of the college. And now there's a secularist wing of the faculty that creates all sorts of resistance to any efforts to reconnect with the church and with its vision. And I define a church institution as something where the Christian vision is publicly relevant. Publicly relevant. So if you've got a home for the elderly, by George, there should be some margin of difference between that and a regular secular home. That is, if we believe that the spiritual dimension of life is crucial in our homes for the elderly, that ought to be taken very seriously. Just like in a college, the Christian intellectual heritage should be taken very seriously. If it's not at all, that means the kind of the world has had its way with these institutions, and we no longer are embodying our vision. And one can talk about all the other institutions of the church, but you get the point I'm making, that in the institutions we have to have the courage and clarity to at least make our own vision publicly relevant, and that then has a very important impact upon the world. One other example that's perhaps more fit for politics in the public sphere. On the west side of Chicago, Bethel West, and I'm not sure all the names of the elaborate organization they've created there now, it's a church-related institution, church institution that deals with the poor on the west side of Chicago, and they've become models for the state of Illinois and for the larger country of how you do urban education, how you do housing, how you deal with the poor in many different facets of life, becoming a kind of a model. And then this is picked up by the larger society in ways that are really quite impressive. So they're what Niebuhr called social pioneers, modeling that then the rest of the society picks up. And the churches have a wonderful history of modeling these sorts of things that then are picked up by the rest of the institution. Finally, there's this middle ground that I don't know whether to connect it with the direct way that the church involves itself in society or the indirect. But what I mean by initiating is that if the church indeed does form character, awaken conscience, get people geared up and excited and energized on issues, some public issues, oftentimes they organize into voluntary associations. Not directed by the church, and often spun off by lay people and clergy who recognize that what they're going to do can't be directly connected with the institution. They don't want the control of the institution over them, and they know that they can't fuse what they're going to do too much with the institutional church. So you have the spin-off of all sorts of voluntary associations, maybe Holden being one of them. In fact, I would argue that Holden is one of them. Lay people and clergy who believe that a renewal center, a retreat center up here would be important as a way of educating, conscientizing laity, and they independently establish something like this. The Lutheran Human Relations Association is another example of these kind of spin-offs in England. The Committee for Nuclear Disarmament was a very aggressive, vigorous anti-nuclear weapons group, but it was independent of the church. It was banded together by people who had been formed by the church, but then they took it from there. The Catholic Worker, Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker, and they often can become much more confrontative and controversial because they are voluntary associations, not directly connected with the church. Let me stop there for a moment and see where you're at, what sort of issues you might, questions you might have. Yeah.
As you're probably aware, the ELCA is experiencing some memorials on the part of synods to reconsider the principles of inclusivity, which they've been trying to function with these last 8 years or whatever it's been. And that brings to mind, in the sort of embodying point that you're making, the difficulty, which goes back to writing social statements or developing positions or something. What do you do when a big institution is not of one mind, which I think the ELCA will not be in the next 100 years? We've brought together such disparate traditions into one church body. people of goodwill and, mm-hmm. and intelligence and moral, faithful mm-hmm. people radically disagree with one another about many things, the principles of inclusivity being one of them. Should we insist on mm-hmm. having balances of men and women yeah. and have 10% of people of color? And mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. People don't agree.
No, no.
And I don't think they will.
Nope, they won't.
And that's just one example of an area where they won't.
Yeah, and some of that will have much more to do with my next category, that in intentional influence, when you get into the statements of the church, where the church is trying to articulate something for itself and for the society as an institution. And that's where it becomes more high risk and more controversial and a lot more fracturing. And in that sense, that you're bringing up those sorts of things. Thus far, where I've gone, I've argued that if the church develops an indirect style, it perhaps doesn't have to come down on a lot of these things, but is the moral gadfly for the discussion. Yeah.
I wonder if there's, what the sense is that there was a time when people believed that they could make a difference in a systemic way, mm-hmm. or what you'd call the institutional way. And that was even blessed by a theology of action.
Mm-hmm. You mean these more direct ways that we're
going?
Yes. Gonna, yeah.
And I raised the question is, do people today believe they can make a difference systemically? Have they given up? Are they walking away? Retreating to kind of an individualism, kind of recycling mm-hmm. an individualism that is giving up on any kind of impact on the system. And I think the issue about inclusivity might be one. You know, the manifesto we had in the 60s and the 70s and mm-hmm. things like that, to even say that today is mm-hmm. borders on being a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what that looks like for us impacting in community, where we might be in retreat to an ethics of character.
Mm-hmm.
And young people, you know, admirably volunteering to do individual efforts, mm-hmm. volunteer for great work.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not interested in coming together in an ashram to politically strategize on doing things in the city or, you know, in the rural area.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just not happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what that means or if that's a phase we're going through where people have given up on systemic change and retreating from that.
Well, I think it depends on what spectrum of religious traditions you're talking about. I think that's true in the mainstream traditions. They more or less had their day, perhaps, in the 60s with a lot of direct political involvement. I think if you'd ask the evangelicals, the Christian Coalition people, and the young people that are funneling into those organizations, whether they have any chance of political effect, they'd say, we sure do. So that I think part of it had to do with what we talked about earlier about the emergence and the diminishment of various religious traditions. And I would think that finally it has to do a lot with how churches are doing that first level, how deeply they're implanting in people this ethics of character. And if you begin moving across the chart toward a Christ of culture where there's not much formation going on and people are tugged 100 different ways by popular culture, by their peers, the church is just a wee tiny voice in their formation, you're not going to get the kind of energy either on the first level, the second level, and there's certainly not going to be the troops for the lower level. So I think a lot of it has to do with the energy and depth involved in the formation of people. And I think that that again goes back to what we were talking about a couple days ago about the kind of neo-sectarian movement in which a lot of people who in the mainstream traditions have believed that there's been so much accommodation and compromise that it's time to develop a Christian counterculture that is over against things and start Christian schools and do Christian education a lot more thoroughly than we've been doing. But I think you're right. There is certainly a diminishment of that capacity.
You certainly rightly observe that there seems to be a reluctance, if not disinterest, on the part of congregations and maybe their pastoral leadership to provide inquiry opportunities for members to apply Sunday to Monday.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's certainly true of the ones I belong to. And I'm wondering why the reluctance, why the apathy, or is it fear? Or what is it that caused, I've been trying to initiate those kinds of opportunities in my own congregation. My pastors somewhat reluctantly permit me to do it.
They're a little nervous about that.
Yeah.
They get
and
nervous about that.
Is it fear that someone might become disturbed or challenged, and we don't want that to happen to anyone coming to church? Or what is it? What do you observe there?
Well, I think that it's relatively easy and very nourishing and enriching to work on the calling of the laity at the local level, what it means for laity to have a calling. And I would start there, not with the more controversial political stuff. So what I do every year at our church is run a series of about 4 or 5 weeks in which I try to select lay folks around one profession or one occupation or one sector of employment and have an adult forum in which they, and I choose people who I think have thought about this thing, how they connect their faith commitments with their calling. And we have one doctor, young physician oncologist, who just blew the socks off everybody. And it wasn't totally unexpected. He's the son of Norm Fintel. Some of you know Norm from ALC days. And his son is an oncologist in our town. And what a wonderful interaction of his faith, his Christian values, with the way he's a doctor and how he treats patients and how he encounters patients and raises a spiritual question with patients against the kind of training he had in medical school. And the guy is so much in demand that when he took on a couple of partners in this oncology department of the hospital, no one would go to these other partners. In fact, he's got a serious problem. They're underloaded and he's overloaded. But do that with teachers. Do that with homemakers. Do it with... I think that's at a very fundamental level. I think that's more important to me than actually getting to some of the hot-button political issues. Because it's operating at that deepest level. And I find so little consciousness of a sense of calling among the students that I teach. And it's kind of fun to teach because it's a missionary situation. They've never heard of this idea that God might be calling them to put their talents on the line on behalf of their neighbor, that there's a transcendent dimension to your work in the world. So I find it very rewarding to work at that level, and in one way that's avoiding the more controversial issues, but I don't mind that. It gets you to the controversial issues.
That's the first step.
Right, because the doctor, Bill Fintel, will say our medical system's all goofed up. He can't treat some people because they don't have medical insurance, and he's angry about it. And so you get into that sort of thing quickly through the calling.
I certainly agree. I think from what I have seen in public university in the last 30 years, especially among young people, and I guess in the mainline churches, is embodying or initiating is what is catching them. I don't think I've ever seen more evidence of spirituality among people. And what really strikes me is the last place that a lot of these people are looking at is the church. And I think that these statements or whatever just don't hold anything, and they are really looking at a lot of idealism there, and they are ready to commit themselves, and they're going into these para-church organizations or what have you. And I think that when they do see the embodiment of something in an institution, that's what they...
It's more impressive to them. But it's a great challenge to do that because it's a terrific battle between the worldly sources of knowledge and expertise and the Christian vision. And most mainstream people have retreated on all those things. So the psychological model takes over in your home for the elderly, or Lutheran Family Service. I've been on the board of Lutheran Family Services in Virginia. And you've got the professionals within, first of all, it's highly professionalized. The professionals are taught in a perfectly secular model, and there's not even a wisp or an echo of the Christian vision. I mean, if we really believe that to believe in Christ and to live in the Holy Spirit is the way life is renewed and shaped and changed, if you don't have any of that in your institution, why go around calling yourself a Lutheran Family Services? Now, that isn't to mean that you ignore professional expertise, but boy, we've just given up that we have anything to say to it. Yeah.
Well, it's a real problem in public schools, elementary, all of those, because I'm not talking about your church school. Because there are a lot of us that are afraid of this real conservative push that you've got to have prayer in school, and then they want it to be their prayer. So that doesn't attract us. And yet I talk to a lot of teachers who really want to be able to talk about the spiritual values of what a real life is all about and how to do that and be legal. It's a real challenge to teachers.
Sure is. And some of the crazy things that go on from the state's point of view about, you were telling me about people couldn't have their Bibles in class, or teachers couldn't.
There's no Bible in the elementary school library, even as literature, it doesn't exist.
I mean, that's crazy stuff. So that you can understand the conservative reaction to that. I've only got about 5 more minutes, but let me just get in briefly into the next level, the direct. And this is where the church as an institution becomes an actor, and it's intentional, and I call it the church's corporate conscience or the church's social conscience. And this is the best example of this, perhaps, are the social statements of the church, where the church not only tries to teach the social teachings to the laity, but is also speaking to the larger society and trying to be persuasive. This is still influence. When we get to direct action, we get into power questions, which is more coercive. Influence and power are on a continuum, and nothing is ever completely non-coercive, but influence is certainly less coercive. Trying to persuade, first of all, it has to persuade its laity, and oftentimes doesn't succeed in that, but persuading the laity and then making an articulate statement, persuasive statement to the society. And by and large, churches have relied way too much, mainstream churches have relied way too much on this, and often their statements are not paid attention to by their laity or by the overall society. But sometimes they are, and sometimes they're very important. And perhaps the best example of this mode of action is the way the Catholic bishops operate in America and the way the Pope operates in the world. And I've argued in the book basically that the Catholics have become our public theologians, the Roman Catholic bishops, and particularly the Pope. And when the Catholic bishops make a statement and an argument about economics, as they did about a decade ago, every editorialist in the United States and every major newspaper feels constrained to respond to that bishop's statement. And when they made the statement on deterrence, you had this fantastic national discussion on the ethics of deterrence. And the bishops themselves have been overshadowed in recent years by the Pope, who tends to be a very prolific writer. And he is making these major statements, one on capitalism, the nature of market systems in the world, and one on the nature of truth, the splendor of truth. And he's probably writing too many of them, but certainly when he writes them, again, everybody listens and are constrained to respond. And oftentimes they're quite persuasive. Who knows who they persuade in the political sphere, but certainly do carry a kind of moral weight. And the Protestants, the mainstream Protestants, have tried to do similar things and with varying degrees of success. And one of the things we're going to do tomorrow night is to discuss a study document of the ELCA, which got a lot of attention, maybe more attention than was intended, and that was the human sexuality statement, the first draft. And now there's a second draft, but there's so much internal conversation within the church on the statement that I don't know how much thought there is that we're persuading anybody outside. But nevertheless, it hasn't become a statement and doesn't look like it will. It's not going to be voted on this assembly. So, but the ELCA has made a number of social statements. Ingrid's the chair of the Board of Church and Society that is responsible for the social statements. And that's what I mean by this higher and more, this direct and warmer, more controversial way of the church's acting in society. And it is certainly more controversial when lay people hear where the church comes down on in a social statement. They often react with great indignation and say, well, who is speaking for me? That doesn't speak for me. And it creates a good deal of turbulence in the church. We're at the end of our hour. Tomorrow I'll take the next. I'll talk much in more detail about this church's corporate conscience. Make some recommendations or guidelines. What I think will make the church more effective as corporate conscience, and then ratchet it up to the highly controversial way in which the church actually gets involved directly in politics with money, staff, power.
And will you talk more, you mentioned at the very beginning about the Christian conservatives' alleged power in politics.
Uh-huh.
And to speak from just a layperson, I don't hear about the Pope's treatise on truth. I've never heard of that. But I certainly hear about the Christian conservatives all the time. So I'm not sure if I agree with what you say, that the Pope is speaking to the people and the people are reacting. I hear the Christian right speaking.
Well, I think you're making a very good point. And the point you're making is that a voluntary association spun off by the conservative churches, the Christian Coalition, it's not the church directly, is engaging in direct action. And that makes people, if they've got the weight of numbers and actually some potent, some power, that makes people think. And
well, it makes me nervous. And that's what I
want
to
know
more about.
Well, okay, makes you nervous. The Pope is still in influence. He's trying to make an argument. He's not committing battalions to it. But the Catholics do have the capacity to commit large institutional power, too. And I think the Catholic bishops probably do on the abortion issue. They do. And as I said, argued earlier on, Catholics have not had the kind of inhibitions about using direct power that Protestants have had. And now the conservative Protestants are using direct power. But it's through those voluntary associations. So it's not the Southern Baptist Convention. It's not independent churches. It's the Christian Coalition connected with Pat Robertson's organization, which is not the church either. So we'll get into that tomorrow. Good point. Thank you very much.